But clearly there's a race toward artificial general intelligence, AGI, and it's recognized as such by top players on both sides.
I think there's a real chance of automation bias within the Chinese military, that there's concern about making decisions, there's concern about, you know, going against the technology.
Denying chips and other technology to China, it, at best, it delays China's progress. And worst, and I think that's what we're seeing here, it incentivizes Chinese scientists to develop ingenious workarounds.
Hey, welcome back to the Modern War Institute podcast, brought to you with the generous support of the West Point class of 1974. I'm John Amble, and on this episode, we're digging into the artificial intelligence competition between the United States and China. When the Chinese company DeepSeek recently released an AI model called R1, experts quickly noted that its capability is largely on par with some of the most advanced large language models developed by leading US companies like OpenAI. This, and the fact that DeepSeek claims to have trained its model much more cheaply than US companies, sparked a wave of discussion about how rapidly Chinese AI development was progressing. And because both China and the United States see a role for military use of AI, it's a really important discussion. To explore that subject, I'm joined on this episode by two experts from Georgetown University's Center for Security and Emerging Technology. Bill Hannes is lead analyst at CSET, and Sam Bresnik is a CSET research fellow. Before we get to the discussion, a couple of quick notes. First, a very special thank you to the West Point class of 1974 for their generous support to MWI. And second, as always, what you hear in this episode are the views of the participants and don't represent those of West Point, the Army, or any other agency of the U.S. government. All right, here's my conversation with Bill Hannes and Sam Bresnik. Sam and Bill, thank you both so much for joining me in this episode of the MWI podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you. Our pleasure.
So listeners will have heard a little bit about you in the intro. They will have heard that we're going to talk about AI. Before we kind of jump into the substantive discussion, I wonder if I can ask each of you to sort of maybe give listeners a sense of your background, but particularly your research interests and kind of what brought you to the study of the subjects that we're going to talk about today. Sam, if we can start with you.
Yeah, great. So I am a China AI analyst at CSET. I spent almost 3 years in China working at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace's Beijing office, doing more sort of traditional security economics research, and now have transitioned to AI at CSET. My focus now is on military applications of AI. I do a little bit of work on the role of big technology companies in modern conflicts, but I spend a lot of my time, like Bill, reading very dense academic Chinese works, Chinese articles, academic papers on the future of AI and warfare.
Okay, and Bill?
Yeah, like Sam, I'm also a Chinese linguist, which is where you find most of the good material on China anyway. Not surprisingly, it's not in English, it's in Chinese. So my background, I'm a former CIA employee. I was in the senior intelligence service there, and I ran their open source program for monitoring Chinese science and technology. I got interested pretty early on in AI, probably before China did, in fact, just seeing this as a coming thing, and carried that over into my current job at Georgetown, where my small team and I are focused on exactly that, you know, Chinese AI developments. We look at other things. It's impossible to look at it at AI just in isolation, but that is our main focus.
That's fantastic. So the first question that I kind of want to ask you is, you know, what prompted this discussion and my invitation to the both of you to come on the podcast was released over the past couple of weeks of a new AI software application produced by a Chinese company, DeepSeek, DeepSeek R1. It spurred a lot of public discussion. I've seen even, and I think some of it is a bit perhaps hyperbolic, and we'll get into this about whether or not it is. I've seen descriptions of it as sort of an AI Sputnik moment. Hey, this is the moment that we realized how advanced Chinese AI development is. I will be honest, I think for most of our listeners, I include myself in this group, the first time I heard of DeepSeek was when it hit the headlines in these past couple of weeks. for people like you who've been looking at this for a long time, was it as, you know, sort of shocking a tidal wave moment as the kind of public discussion has characterized it at? Or was this something that just sort of confirmed, I guess, your own beliefs based on your research about the state of Chinese AI development?
I can't say that anyone on my team was particularly surprised by it. We were surprised mostly by the large reaction to it, and certainly how the stock market reacted. But, you know, we need to put this thing into perspective. The announced development time and cost, it really excludes other significant expenses, prior art, hardware, and whatnot. So I'm not sure that making direct comparisons between their announced costs and time for doing it is necessarily appropriate. You know, that said, the model does function well, you know, within the scope for which it was designed. To DeepSeek's appearance, I don't know if I'd go as far as to call it a sputtering moment. It tells us three things. That the gap between China and the U.S. is shorter than imagined, which we sort of already knew. You don't need to mortgage the country to be at the cutting edge to move AI forward. That's an important takeaway. And another one, denying chips and other technology to China, at best, it delays China's progress. And worst, and I think that's what we're seeing here, it incentivizes Chinese scientists to develop ingenious workarounds. Another important factor, that the fact that the Western world was surprised is testimony to how poorly we monitor Chinese science, scientific development, and that needs to change. And that, to me, is a bigger wake-up call than the merits of the software itself. You know, without some kind of serious monitoring system that we, and I speak the nation as a whole, currently lack, you know, you have to wonder what other new developments we're going to miss. And by contrast, I can assure you, China's not burdened by a similar lack of insight into what we're doing.
And what does the monitoring framework look like? Because, you know, giving into the temptation, which is a mistake sometimes, but giving into the temptation of comparing the U.S.-China competition right now to the Cold War, you know, this is something we did in the past with things like ballistic missiles and nuclear weapons. But these are tangible things. It's a lot easier to monitor and verify them with a variety of different sort of intelligence disciplines. You know, for something less tangible like AI capabilities, is it, you know, are we talking about a sort of a political framework in which various states sort of give access to each other in order to monitor the state of their AI capability development?
That's one way to do it. That's an important thing. That's not the particular emphasis of our team. We're more interested, number one, in determining, you know, what technological progress is being made. And there are ways to do that. You monitor the literature. Chinese scientists, like scientists everywhere in the world, love to talk about what their accomplishments are. They do it through known venues, and you look at that, keep an eye on it. A monitoring program can be as broad or as narrow as you want. You can have a couple of people looking at one particular aspect of it that people regard as important. For example, pathways to artificial general intelligence, where you can expand it to a full-scale operation of a few dozen people, where you're looking at the particular technology, China's ability to implement it, and upstream and downstream derivatives of that. But in terms of, you know, you want to talk about what a monitoring system looks like, I'll throw a figure at you, and it's valid because it comes right from the horse's mouth. You know, China itself devotes, by their admission, some 100,000 specialists, so-called S&T intelligence researchers, to looking at what's happening in the rest of the world. Hmm. They've been doing it for a couple of decades, so it's really lopsided. They have an advantage there, and I think it shows in many areas.
If we circle back to DeepSeek, Sam, do you have anything to add? What were your sort of initial takeaways from DeepSeek's release?
You know, this does not mean that export controls are not working per se, because there's a lag, right, between when the controls were instituted and when you're going to see more of a bite coming into Chinese AI innovation. But I do think what it shows is that it's not enough for the U.S. to rely solely on export controls to outcompete China. There's going to need to be more of a focus on pushing things forward in the United States. And I think in that way, it's an important wake-up call. Again, I wouldn't call it a Sputnik moment. I would call it an important point for the people focusing on driving U.S. AI innovation forward, that, you know, there needs to be more efforts on the algorithm side of things. Another important point, right, is that, as Bill said, China is getting creative. And I think this is a really significant moment in that as China is constrained on chips and as, you know, the export controls bite, and we could see more and more of a difference in the raw computing power between the United States and China, we could see different paradigms of AI development start to emerge in the U.S. and China. The U.S. could, you know, as it seems like it's going to do with this Stargate initiative, with, you know, up to $500 billion in AI infrastructure, it appears that we're going to, or the U.S. AI ecosystem is doubling down on compute. And as this gap opens with China, China may, as it has done with DeepSeek, focus more on the algorithm side. And it's unclear to the extent to which, at least when it comes to LLMs, that China will be able to keep up if it is more and more compute constrained. There's some evidence that they might be able to as a fast follower. But I think we could see two different AI development paradigms open up on the LLM side going forward. And it could be that, you know, they're equally or similarly capable or not. But this is something to watch going forward. And a final thing I'll say on this is the open source angle of DeepSeek, I think, is something that, you know, a lot of people are talking about in the AI world, but is an important thing for people who might not follow this space so closely to understand. Most of the cutting edge frontier AI systems in the United States are closed source, right? OpenAI, they do not release their model weights. They don't give you a sense of how exactly they've trained the model. And they don't allow people to download their models onto their computers and run them locally. DeepSeek allows you to download its lightweight models onto its computer and to tweak them, to fine tune them for specific applications. Mm. And I think going forward, you know, there is going to be a bit of a tension between, you know, people who want the most powerful models, which, for example, might still be the OpenAI or you know, Google offerings going forward, or if they want Chinese models that are open source, cheaper to use, and, you know, potentially downloadable onto your computer so that you can fine tune them. So there's a tension again between the most capable and then the good enough AI, if you will, that is easier for people to use and cheaper.
You mentioned export controls. This has been an effort fairly recently to limit sort of Chinese access to advanced chips, right? Paul Shari's book, Four Battlegrounds, I found really interesting. And it's sort of, as you know, as a novice in this area, has always provided kind of a framework that has been really useful for me, talking about development of AI being really driven by four factors: access to data, compute, talent, and institutions. And so if these export controls are limiting Chinese access to compute, that, as you said, doesn't necessarily mean they can't just put more emphasis on the talent or on the data to kind of overcome some of those shortcomings. Do you find that to be a useful framework for thinking about how there are different pathways toward getting toward the ultimate objective of functional AI?
I think that's largely a good way to think about things. You know, the people who really believe in the efficacy of export controls will tell you that, you know, at least when it comes to LLMs, there is going to be a cost for China to not having as much compute that is going to be hard to make up. But there are, you know, other people who think that we're going to move away, right, from LLMs toward alternative methods that Bill is better positioned to talk about than I am. But I do think there's something to pushing more on the algorithm side of things, and even the data side of things. And, you know, DeepSeek obviously made several algorithmic innovations. But the other things I would point to are electricity, right? China has a newer electric grid than we do. They appear to have more capacity to you know, use that electricity than we do at this point. And the other thing is, you know, there are ways to get models outside of developing them yourself, right? So a lot of DeepSeek made news in part because it appears they distilled some OpenAI models, right? They queried it thousands of times and took the outputs that helped train their models, right? So that's called model distillation. It seems difficult to prevent that completely. There are some companies working on this, But another thing, right, is espionage. You know, a lot of these US AI labs, they have the model weights, right? You do all the AI, you do the training to get the model weights, right? Which for closed source models like OpenAI are not available to the public. But, you know, China could potentially steal those model weights, right? And then have access to, you know, the models and, you know, develop them from there. There are some restrictions on that, but, you know, I think there's a little bit more to just developing the models, as we've seen from like the AI triad and the institutions angle. But I would leave it there.
Bill, I want to ask you, you know, we mentioned, and it is perhaps a bit of an exaggeration to call this a sort of AI Sputnik moment, but there's a really fundamental difference, right? Sputnik sort of kicked off this space race. The space race was undertaken by two respective governments, right? AI development is something very different because it incorporates, it largely takes place in the private sector. Sure, there's a place, certainly in China, there's a place for the state to sort of put its finger on the scale. But even in the US with the Stargate initiative, where the federal government is sort of working with private companies to sort of put together this package to advance AI capabilities, we're talking about really consumer products right here when we're talking about OpenAI's offerings and DeepSeek. But obviously the context of this is that there are military applications of AI. Is it a useful framework to think about, you know, advanced AI development in terms of some sort of AI arms race?
I don't think arms race is the best name for it because it militarizes the contest when the most significant outcomes are likely to be economic, cultural, cognitive, and political. But clearly there's a race toward artificial general intelligence, AGI, and it's recognized as such by top players on both sides. Now, there was a feel-good meme that circulated a few years ago proposing that if we don't call the competition a race, it won't become a race. Everyone will be happy. They'll cooperate to develop safe AI for the betterment of humanity, et cetera, et cetera. And you don't hear that argument too much nowadays. I think U.S.-China collaboration on AI's dangers is a good thing, you know, if we could agree on what constitutes a danger. But there's no getting around the fact that both sides see advantages in being the first to develop, artificial superintelligence, ASI, that is AI that self-improves by rewriting its own source code. And, you know, the dystopian scenario there is that, you know, once that's done, you know, whoever has it first is always ahead because no one could ever catch up. Who knows? But this race to the bottom was predicted by early AI theorists, Bostrom, Yukovsky, others. And we are probably seeing caution thrown to the wind by large model developers competing with themselves and with China. You know, and allowing these same companies to advise government on AI regulation, you know, to me is tantamount to letting the fox guard the hen house.
Can you talk a little bit more about that sort of regulatory framework question? Because, you know, there's obviously an ongoing discussion about the need, the fundamental importance of having some sort of supranational structure in place, an agreement that states can sign up to that you know, puts some controls on the way that AI is operationalized, particularly in military context. But there's also that domestic component, right? A domestic regulatory framework, excuse me. Can you talk a little bit more about the development of these frameworks, of these tools?
Nick Bostrom, who wrote, I can't remember, he was the grandfather of AI doom. He's no longer has those views. He sees good things happening nowadays. But in one of his papers somewhere, he considered, you know, what's the best way to do governance. And there are two possibilities that he considered. You know, one is an international consortium where everybody gets together and tries to do something about a common problem. The other one is you've got some kind of hegemon, one nation that gets there before the others and imposes a Pax China or Pax Americana on everybody else. And he said the first of these alternatives, you know, has about a snowball's chance at hell of happening. And his, as I recall, I hope I'm remembering him correctly, he believes that the latter choice, where one country has a commanding lead and reigns over the development of AI for the betterment of humanity, you know, better that should be the United States with liberal democratic values than another country whose values are certainly not the same. Well, they're his conclusions, not mine. I don't even know if he still holds them, but it makes pretty good sense to me. And you know, as an American, I would like to see. I think we're a whole lot safer, you know, if we push ahead and look at AI safety, see AI safety as part of our own national security requirements. I don't see the two as being fundamentally different.
Sam, do you have any sort of views, any perspective on the utility of characterizing the AI competition between the United States and China as an arms race? You know, beyond the point that Bill made, the important point that Bill made, that you know it risks perhaps overemphasizing the military dimension of this competition.
Yeah, the thing that gets me a little bit frustrated about that framing, I should say, is that I think it oversells the importance of technological development while underselling the importance of adoption. And so what we hear about when we think about AI race, right, what we hear all the time is that, you know, there are these technological innovations, you know, it's Silicon Valley versus Beijing, right? But I think more important, and Jeffrey Ding from George Washington University wrote a good book on this, on AI diffusion, right? That actually more important than the innovation is the diffusion, is how you use this stuff. And I think, you know, we're not paying close enough attention to how the two countries are actually applying this technology. And, you know, I focus on the military side of things, and I wrote a recent piece in Foreign Affairs trying to make the point that it doesn't really matter which country has the best technology if they don't know how to use it properly. And while, you know, China seems to be making some good progress on developing AI for specific applications in the economic sense, more sort of tailored, smaller models, whereas we are focusing on large frontier models mostly. I think in the military context, the US actually might have an advantage in AI adoption because there's more of a culture of trust. Younger, less senior, more junior officers, I should say, have decision-making capability in the U.S. military, as opposed to China, where it's very bureaucratized, very top-down. And I think, you know, the way the military is thinking about using AI, for instance, and your listeners and you would, you know a lot about this, I presume. But you know, there's this idea of human-machine teaming that you want to have the operator working with an AI system, and you know, to help you make decisions. I think the U.S. has a potential advantage here because of the mission command angle in the U.S. military, whereas China, you know, China's trying actually to replace human decisions with AI-enabled decisions, which I think is dangerous for a number of reasons and also might not be as efficacious as it seems the human-machine teaming angle would be.
You know, one of the other, I guess, problems of potentially of characterizing the AI competition as an arms race is that it risks treating the participants in that arms race as sort of monolithic beings. But we know that in the United States, for instance, if you sit in Silicon Valley, your outlook on AI from the standpoint of development pathways to use cases, what have you, is probably going to be very different than if you sit in the Pentagon. I'm sure that, you know, a similar level of sort of heterogeneity of perspectives exists in China. Bill, I wonder if you can kind of weigh in from your observations on what sort of discussions we're seeing on that front or in that regard within China.
Like, I guess the broader question even is, you know, how do the two approaches of US and China differ? You know, as reflected both in reality and the rhetoric surrounding that reality. There's two ways to look at the question. You know, one is the differences in technological approaches, and as Sam pointed out, very importantly, the differences in implementation. Not the same thing. So, you know, in the former case, there's overlap, but it's not complete. The U.S. is fixated on what I would call a monoculture of large generative models, and the premise being that the so-called scaling laws, the more compute you have, the better results, will persist forever, but there's evidence that we're bumping up against limits already. And China's top scientists are aware of this. They've been aware of it for a while, and they're not by a long shot wedded to this notion that that's the only way to pursue advanced AI. It's one way, and China is pursuing these same generative models in a big way, no question about it. But its top scientists are pretty clear about the need not to put all of the eggs in one basket. So, you know, if AGI, human equivalent AI or better, is the goal, there may be other ways to get there that are more specifically brain-inspired. This is their argument, and I agree with it, including neuromorphic chips, for example, or writing mathematical models of brain function, trying to implement that on silicon, or adding dedicated modules, which we're doing also, to large models to address the shortcomings of their purely statistical approach, which, again, corresponds to what we find in the brain itself, discrete areas specialized for specific functions. And, you know, there's our non-therapeutic uses of brain-computer interfaces, which China has been and is looking at very seriously. And some of their top figures who know what they're talking about, you know, see this as potentially morphing into a form of artificial general intelligence. They're not the least bit shy about talking about the fusion, and they mean that literally, of artificial and human intelligence. You know, to go way out there is at least one well-funded Chinese outfit that we identified that at one time was experimenting with fast genetic algorithm approach to AGI, aimed at forcing AI to evolve to a super state. Finally, there's an important movement in China backed by state funds to reach AGI by embodying AI models in real or realistic surroundings. Learning happens by interacting with the environment. And again, this is modeled on how biological brains add intelligence. This is my own team's current topic of research. I don't want to get ahead of our conclusions, but I can tell you assuredly that China's pursuing this path in a very serious way. Now, these are the technical differences. In terms of implementation, China, historically and now, has always emphasized practical applications, not just for AI, but for new technologies in general. It's a historical phenomenon. China excels at this so-called intra-representational form of creativity. That is where you arrange elements within a cognitive matrix, not necessarily going outside that matrix. You can certainly make a lot of progress within it. Where advances are made incrementally to paradigms that are introduced not necessarily in China, but often from abroad. The upshot is China is very good at commercializing discoveries, which at the end of the day is what matters. Kai-Fu Lee, who wrote AI Superpowers, that's his main point. My team completely agrees with that thesis.
Yeah, for listeners that are interested, it's really fascinating work that your team has done. Your team produced a report. You can find it on the CSET website. It's called Chinese Critiques of Large Language Models. I found it really fascinating and really illuminating because I think I had fallen into the trap a little bit. I know LLMs and AI are not one and the same. And yet because large language models are sort of the form of AI that the public has had the most direct engagement with, it's easy to sort of equate the two, which is, you know, a false equation. So your report did a good job of kind of reminding us that that's not the only form of that AI can take. And also, you know, that there are multiple sort of development pathways that it can take. Sam, you work, you know, specifically on the military applications of artificial intelligence. In the U.S. military, we're grappling with questions like, should a human be on the loop? Should a human be in the loop in terms of control over what AI does? Are those the same sort of conversations that are happening within the Chinese military?
Yeah, they are. Those kinds of discussions are certainly happening in China, which is somewhat surprising for people, I think, who don't read these kinds of documents. But, you know, the Chinese military community is concerned about, you know, ethics, concerned about bias, concerned about, you know, how to control AI systems. I guess the biggest difference I would identify in how we talk about safe, responsible, trustworthy AI and how they do is there's more of a focus on controllability. We don't have that word. We sort of say governability or governance of AI systems, more governability than governance. But for them, there's this emphasis on controllability. There's a fear of losing control of AI systems. And that makes sense, right? Because the Communist Party of China, right, is very interested in control. But I would say, you know, there are... The difference isn't necessarily so much in the language as it is in the ways they're going to use these things and the way they want to use these technologies. And what I get concerned about, right, is I mentioned a little bit earlier, this idea of trying to automate around officers, warfighters in the field to make decisions, you know, at higher levels of command using AI tools. And I think this could be dangerous for a number of reasons, because I think for the foreseeable future, people on the front lines are going to have a better sense of what's going on with AI tools than people, you know, sitting hundreds or thousands of miles away in command centers. And I think there's going to be a tendency in the Chinese military to try to make those decisions at higher levels, even potentially going all the way up, right? I mean, I'm not sure if you've seen this, but the news broke recently in the Financial Times that China's building a command center 10 times the size of the Pentagon outside of Beijing. And, you know, given Vladimir Putin's reported involvement in tactical operations in Ukraine, making those decisions, right? I think there's a similar drive in China to have higher level people make these decisions, which I think is potentially dangerous. And the last thing I'll say on this is, I think there's a real chance of automation bias within the Chinese military, that there's concern about making decisions. There's concern about, you know, going against the technology because, you know, the technology is going to be designed to make decisions. And this might be painting with a little bit too broad a brush, but I think the Chinese military is more likely to have automation bias issues that could lead to AI-related accidents or crises because of this potential over-dependence on the technology coupled with lack of trust within the military chain of command.
But compared to maybe other militaries, a greater trust in the technology?
I think the greater trust in the technology is coming from the top. I think the incentives are for people down the chain of command to trust the technology, because the people at the top don't trust the people at the bottom to make decisions. And so the people at the top are going to say, you know, we want you to use this technology. Now, there's evidence that, you know, even more senior Chinese officers don't necessarily trust the technology either. So you have a dual, you have a two-level trust problem. You have a trust problem between Chinese officers and their subordinates, and then you have a trust problem between the technology and the people. And so that's why I think, you know, there's more evidence that the US is going to be able to operationalize AI-enabled tools more efficiently than China is. And I think China's putting a lot of its eggs in the AI-enabled decision support system basket, that they might not be completely aware of some of the issues they're going to face. There are some, I should say, some people writing in China about the need to adopt a more flexible command structure, taking cues from the United States military. I think right now they're in the minority. And so seeing how that develops going forward is going to be a really interesting thing and something that I'm tracking closely.
How closely is the Chinese military involved in the actual development of AI technologies in China? Because, you know, for a point of comparison, in the U.S. military, we've got acquisitions pipelines, procurement pipelines. And for, you know, in most cases, regardless of what capability we're talking about, service members don't really get their hands on a new capability until it's been purchased and fielded. With a few exceptions, notably the 18th Airborne Corps and the Maven Smart System, where you had developers and engineers sat next to practitioners, sat next to soldiers, really attacking these problems in tandem, working together. What does it look like in China? Is the Chinese military actively involved in the development of these sort of AI capabilities?
You know, in China, as opposed to the United States, there is a much more robust civil military fusion program, which has been a strategic priority now for several years. Xi Jinping institutionalized this toward the beginning of his term, and it essentially is a program to more closely integrate the civilian technology companies with the PLA, and to try to feed the PLA some of the innovations that are coming out of, you know, the increasingly impressive Chinese technology enterprise. And I think the jury is out as to whether or not this is quote unquote working. But from a project that I am working on with another CSET colleague, Cole McFall, we are seeing that there are a lot of companies getting involved in the Chinese military industrial complex that weren't involved several years ago. So I think there is some evidence emerging now that the military civil fusion program, you know, though it's difficult to measure, though, you know, it's rife with issues, is actually potentially, you know, further linking the PLA with these companies in a way that could feed more technological progress into the PLA.
Bill, I think, you know, given the nature and the scope of your research, I think you'd have some pretty interesting insights on this next question that I want to ask, and that's about sort of visibility between China and U.S. AI development kind of communities, you know, because there are multiple sort of stakeholders involved in this, right? You've got governments, and from the perspective of the Chinese and U.S. governments, a lot of this stuff is classified, so they're clearly not sharing a lot of information on this. You've got private companies, and from a market perspective, there's clearly not a lot of incentive to share, you know, status updates about the progress of their development of AI tools. But there's also the scientific component. And, you know, for science, one of the hallmarks is scholarly discourse. And so you would think that maybe there is some kind of crosstalk among the scientific communities involved here. But if we consider China as sort of an AI development ecosystem and US as an AI development ecosystem, how much kind of, not necessarily communication, but maybe visibility is there on one another?
Well, needless to say, we don't have any access into classified programs.
Of course.
In China, for that matter, but not even in the United States. So I can't respond to that aspect of the question. But in terms of, you know, we look at open source, and in when you're dealing with science and technology, the figure I hear all the time is 85% or more of what you need to know to understand the whole thing is available in open source if you know where to look. That's where the exchanges are taking place. And in terms of, you know, one side knowing and or collaborating with what the other side is doing, there's a lot of that going on. And there are several dimensions. You know, one is you see this in co-authored papers. I look at a lot of scientific papers, my colleagues and I, and I have to say that, you know, even when you're not looking for Chinese authorship, you're finding ethnic Chinese names with people who are claiming active affiliations in the PRC, you know, co-authoring on cutting-edge documents on AI and related disciplines all the time. Of course, I'm looking for it, so I'm biased, but, you know, my gut feeling is it's not just all the time, it's most of the time. So there is that element. That's a form of exchange. People know one another in the community. They know what they're working on. Is this always a good thing? Not necessarily. You know, we need to capitalize on what advantages we have to win this race, you know, and that is our ability to do, you know, stay at the cutting edge in the theoretical aspects of AI, at least, you know, which is where we have had a traditional advantage.
You've actually sort of segued very nicely into what I think is arguably one of the most fundamentally important questions surrounding this subject. You know, if we accept that this is a competition, that the competition has largely taken the form of a race, we don't know what the finish line is, but let's assume that the finish line is artificial general intelligence, right? AI that matches or exceeds human cognitive capabilities. What are the relative advantages that each side, the United States on one hand and China on the other, bring to that race?
So, you know, the usual approach to this question is to delineate the factors you believe to be responsible for AI progress, namely access to data, compute, smart algorithms, which is another way of saying talent, and of course, power, electricity. And we discussed this already, but then one tries to digitize each factor based on information that is mostly guesswork. I don't put a lot of stock in this quantitative approach or in efforts to calculate how much each side spends on AI, because there are too many variables and too many unknowns. But looking, you know, at the qualitative advantages that one side or the other has, it pretty much breaks down into this. You know, U.S. has an edge in theoretical science, unquestionably. China, by contrast, has a storied ability to make improvements, you know, to advances that are not necessarily made in China but elsewhere, and to commercialize them quickly, which is very important. So, you know, the question I would leave you with is, which would you rather have, a formula on a blackboard or a decent algorithm working on chips that are good enough?
I would add a couple other things. I think a really interesting thing to think about is the VC markets in these two countries and the role governments play in this space. And, you know, the United States has a very robust venture capital market, which injects a lot of capital into, you know, companies that are claiming, at least at the beginning, to do innovative work on technologies, including AI. China right now has a very, very sparse VC market. The Chinese economy is having some issues. There's just not as much money coming from private or even, you know, I think, or I'll leave it at private VC firms. But what China has an advantage in is, you know, government funding, right? The United States does not have the ability right now to direct capital in the way the PRC does. And I think this is important for one real reason here, which I will highlight, which is that the VC cycle, right, is like 5 to 7 to 10 years. You wanna have a quick return on your investment. And sometimes, you know, technologies take a long time to mature, right? And so, you know, AI is moving really fast right now, but for some of these applications that Bill highlighted earlier, you know, what if these are still 10 to 15 years away? They're probably not going to be good candidates for VC funding, but the Chinese government has more patient capital to nurture these companies or these labs doing this work. And I think that's an advantage they have in this sort of longer term, taking a longer view and not pushing forward or not pushing for profitability very quickly. And I think that extends also into another side of things here, which is that, you know, we again are very focused on profitability. And sometimes there are really important technologies that the PRC is focusing on that might actually not be that profitable, but that might have really important, you know, military or scientific applications. And one program, one industrial policy program I will highlight is this Little Giants program, which I have talked about elsewhere. But essentially, it is a program where the Chinese government subsidizes startups that are working on very specific niche technologies that, again, maybe, you know, there only needs to be one of these globally, right? Like special welding technologies for submarines, for example. These are not going to be profitable companies, right? The Chinese system has a way to innovate those and to adopt them in a way that we might not. And I think that, you know, I know we're talking about AI here. I think that applies on some level also to the AI space, where there are applications outside of LLMs, right? Because we need to remember AI is not only LLMs, especially when we're thinking about the military space. LLMs, they can be important right now already in some decision support systems, but in most AI applications for the military, LLMs are not the main thing. And so I worry a little bit that we are over-focused on LLMs, like Bill said, and that also we don't have as much capital invested in these longer-term, potentially not so profitable, but really strategically important technologies.
Well, to close out, I kind of want to zoom out. We've talked a lot about the very current state of play, so to speak, of the AI competition between the United States and China. If we're looking forward, you know, for listeners who want to continue to kind of monitor this or keep an eye on it, what are the trends and the indicators that you would recommend that they look out for? And what are you going to be watching over the months and years to come? Bill, maybe we can start with you.
Whatever China is doing, you know, a couple of years ago, two years ago, my colleagues and I put together a really extensive list of things to look out for. It had several, three parts to it, you know, concepts that were important, technologies that were going to play a role that needed to be watched, and then a really long keyword list that would trigger alerts for the streams of data that we were looking at that would indicate China's moving in a direction that we need to care about. You know, these are things that we're going to be doing internally. We have plans to put together a pilot watch board of sorts, in other words, to make the kind of research that we have been doing. My team and I at CSET pretty much hit or miss to try to inject some kind of discipline into that. So we're not looking at, we're not missing things. We knew of DeepSeek. And we know of many companies that are doing research, you know, prior to this hitting, you know, becoming a headline. but I can't say we looked at it very hard. And that's not acceptable. You know, we and others who care about the staying ahead or even getting ahead need to leave no stone unturned. And I think our focus internally, at least for the next year or two, is going to be on trying to put together this watchboard that we've been complaining about the lack of for some time. So, you know, what should other people be looking at? I don't know. We're going to worry first about what we need to be looking at. But it's not a bad idea to understand, you know, what AI and AGI theoreticians are saying about potential futures to get a sense of what you need to pay attention to that's happening today. And that's another area that we'll be looking at too, reading the broad literature to understand what is possible, so that when we see glimmers of it, you know, we have a better sense of what direction it's moving in.
And Sam, what are you going to be watching?
I'm going to be looking at two specific things over the next, let's say, year. In no particular order, one of them is there going to be another divergence, a novel divergence in capabilities between US and Chinese models? Because that is going to tell us on some level, are export controls working, right? The theory is that you're gonna put more and more compute, you're gonna get more and more data centers, cloud computing centers online here in the United States over the next year plus. And as China continues to be compute constrained, there's an idea among the people who are really gung-ho about export controls that is going to drive a difference, right? A divergence in the capabilities of these models. So I think in the next couple of years, we'll have a better sense of the extent to which export controls are quote unquote working. The second thing I'm going to be looking at is the user numbers and the general usage of US versus Chinese models. Because I think, as I mentioned before, there's a debate already, right, over these closed versus open source models and whether or not users are going to want the most capable models, the most powerful models, right? O3, which is not quite out yet, but the O3 Mini is out from OpenAI, right? That is now considered, or will be considered when it comes out, the leading model. It's going to be more expensive to use than DeepSeek's R1. Are we going to see people, you know, want to use the most powerful models or cheaper, easier to use, easier to potentially customize and fine-tune Chinese models that are quote-unquote good enough? I'm going to be looking at this to see, you know, that because that's going to be a big issue going forward. Are you more interested in the American closed-source models or the Chinese open-source models? And of course, there are some U.S. open-source ones as well. They're not quite at the frontier in the way that the others are. But this, I think, is going to tell us something going forward about what users actually want from AI and how they're going to use it.
Well, Bill and Sam, I want to thank you both again for joining me on the MWI podcast. It has been a fascinating discussion for me to take part in, and I trust it will be equally fascinating for listeners. I do want to note really quickly, the work that CSET does is really, really important for listeners that really want to kind of keep their finger on the pulse of some pretty important subjects that sit at the sort of intersection of security and technology. CSET is an invaluable resource, so I highly encourage any listeners to go check it out. Bill and Sam, thank you again.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to the MWI podcast. One last thing, if you aren't following MWI on social media, you can find us on Twitter/X, Facebook, or LinkedIn. It is a great way to stay up to date on all of the new articles, podcast episodes, research, and more that we're publishing every day. Thanks again.